is The Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
A very good afternoon. It's just after 12 o'clock on City Talk 105.9. And this is Larry Neal with The Commons Touch. It's our weekly look at politics. I suppose for most of us, when we think of politics, we think of the Labour Party, the Conservatives, and maybe even the Liberal Democrats. They're the big three in the political landscape. But there's a fourth party nibbling away and gaining support from voters disenchanted or disengaged from the big three. This party has just one MP in the House of Commons and around 60 local councillors. It also has 10 Euro MPs, which you may find amazing as it's the stated aim to bring Britain out of the EU. All will be explained today by my guest, John Whittaker. He's one of 9 Euro MPs in the Northwest who is a member of UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party. John, good afternoon.
Hello, Larry.
Well, UKIP was formed 15 years ago, making it a new political kid on the block. So who formed it?
It was a group of about 9 or 10 people. I wasn't a part of it then, but I joined actually the very next year. I'd never been in politics before. I just couldn't stand the idea that we'd be giving away government of this country to the European Union. And, well, I joined, and blow me down, 3 weeks after I joined, there was a by-election came up from where I was born, which was Oldham and Saddleworth. I thought, well, this has to be my destiny. I've got to go and fight this for UKIP. So with absolutely green and no experience whatever, I moved in and stood for UKIP in that by-election. I was very proud to get about 500 votes in Oldham.
Was this for the council or parliament?
No, this was a parliamentary by-election in 1995.
So you got 500 votes?
Yes.
And you were happy with that?
I was very proud because, I mean, you've got a small party like that with only a handful of members. To break in on the political scenery and get 500-odd votes is quite good.
You've got about 17,000 members in UKIP. How would you describe a typical UKIP member?
It's very hard. I think the only thing you can say about UKIP members is that they're all deeply committed to what they think should happen to Britain. Amongst them, like in any organisation, you've got, I suppose, about 2,000 or 3,000 who work jolly hard, and the rest are just supporters. They pay their money, they stay up as members, but they don't do anything particularly active. We're all zealots, but if you want to look at the background, they come from everywhere. It's often said that we're a place where the disaffected Tories go. But I can tell you, around the north of England up here, I think a large proportion of our supporters are jolly good old socialists who don't agree with the way that the country and the government's gone and have joined us from that side of things.
Well, John, at this stage, what I normally do when I've got an MP, I climb into the speaker's chair and wave some questions at them. It's my moment of power, actually, that's all right. So can I ask you these questions?
Oh, you're welcome. Yes, Larry.
So, right, John, there we go. So you're John Whittaker from UKIP. John, where were you born?
I come from Oldham.
Oldham. I mean, what? Oldham. What's Oldham like?
Well, it's a lot different from when I was born there. And I'm fairly saddened when I go back to Oldham. It's been a most important part of the development of the North West, and I'm proud of my Oldham ancestry.
What's it famous for?
Oh, it's cotton, of course. My dad and his dad and his dad were all involved in the cotton industry until it had got into difficult times in the 20s and 30s.
What schools did you go to?
I went to a boarding school. I went to Shrewsbury, and I'm very pleased to have gone there, and I wish more kids around here have the opportunity to go to a school like that.
Do you have any pets?
No.
Have you ever had pets?
No, I haven't. Only children, that's enough.
Just children, okay. Yeah. And what inspired you to get into politics?
Just a disillusionment with the way things were going. I don't believe that what we've got, the setup that we've got at the moment, where 80% of our laws is made by somebody at some organisation across the channel there, which consists of unelected representatives. 80% of the laws comes from over there, and our parliament just has to rubber stamp them all. It's a very silly sort of thing, a very strange political arrangement. If you think, is that going to last? We've got a setup where we elect our politicians to make our laws, and they're not making our laws, they're just rubber stamping laws that come from somewhere else. I don't think that's an endurable situation.
I'm no doubt we'll talk more about that later, John, into the programme. So, who's been the biggest influence on your political career?
That's pretty hard to say. I don't think it's any particular person. It's rather circumstances that's been the influence. Although perhaps I might cite my own brother, who used to run a family business in Oldham. And every time I met him, he expressed to me how much his business was being damaged by endless reams of regulation. And when I started looking at all this, it wasn't hard to find out where most of it was coming from, i.e. European Union.
What's the most difficult decision you've had to make as a politician?
Well, can I get one thing straight first, Larry? I don't consider myself as a politician. I'm not in this as a political career. In fact, I'm not even standing again next time round. Not that I'm not... I don't think UKIP's doing a good job. It's just that it's time to pass the baton on to somebody else, perhaps somebody a bit younger. And I've got other things I want to do. As you know, I'm actually involved as an economist at Lancaster University. I'd rather like to get back to doing some of that job.
What's the worst thing about being a politician, even though you're not one? Obviously, you come across a lot of politicians, so you can think, I'll tell you what's worse about being a politician, it's this.
Well, I'll tell you what, you will have spoken to, or you will be speaking to, some of my MEP colleagues from the North West here.
Yes.
And they will tell you, they'll give you a bit of a different story, they will tell you that they're doing a lot of useful things over in Brussels because they are looking at all this legislation that's coming our way, and they are getting it modified, amended, at the edges to try and make it a little less malignant. Should we have some examples? Like, for instance, there's a huge directive gone through on registration of chemicals. Common things we've been using for 30 years, like bath soap and so on, that now have to be registered. And that means they have to go through a process of inspection of their... And it puts a lot of cost onto these things. And, of course, then my colleagues will be in there trying to get the directive changed a wee bit so that perhaps it's less damaging on local businesses. Are they doing any good? Well, maybe they are, just a bit at the edges, but I'm sorry, but I believe the whole thing is just rotten to the core and Britain would be far better off out of it. And then I'd be the first to be delighted if we all lost our jobs as MEPs.
Well, perhaps this is difficult for you as well, John, but I was going to ask you, what's the best thing about being a politician?
Well, dear me, one could be really cynical here, and it's not for me because I've told you that I'm not standing again next time round, but for some politicians, of course, they are very happy to have the remuneration that goes with the job.
It's good pay, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good pay.
What's your proudest moment? It obviously wasn't being elected as MEP in Brussels.
No, not me personally being elected in Brussels, but I suppose my proudest moment was when UKIP was elected with 2.7 million votes to the European Parliament with our, in 2004 it was, when we got all those votes and sent 12 MEPs to the European Parliament.
And do you work closely together with your MEP colleagues?
Well, absolutely. We all try and swim the same way, but we're all individuals, we're all zealots, and we're all fighting for the same thing, but probably in slightly different ways.
I probably know the answer to this question as well, John, but what one law would you introduce if you could?
Well, you do know the answer, isn't it? We'd repeal the 1972 Act of Parliament, which took us into the European Union, or European Community, as it was then.
You really would bring us out?
Yeah. Yes, we're quite capable of looking after ourselves. Norway and Switzerland aren't members of the European Union. Per capita, they're the richest countries in Western Europe. We don't need to be part of the European Union. We keep being told, for instance, though, that 3.5 million jobs in Britain depend on membership of the European Union through our trade. They may be connected with that trade, but the thing is that trade would not cease if we left the European Union. This is the biggest piece of spin that's always put out as countering our court, and it's nonsense. It just is not true. The European Union countries need our trade more than we need theirs.
See, my view on Europe as an entity is that it gives the continent far more security, safety and security.
Yeah, that's another argument that's commonly put forward. I think possibly the counter to that argument is best illustrated topically by the reaction to the problems in Georgia, where you have a completely different attitude between countries like Germany and France on the one hand and Britain on the other, where Germany and France are so very dependent on supplies from Russia of oil and gas. So they've taken a very lenient attitude towards Russia, whereas our government, and particularly the Conservative opposition, are being much more hawkish on it and think we should stand up to Russia. Now, if you have countries within the European Union with such divergent views, and there are many examples of this, how on earth are you going to suggest that that's better for running a common defence force, looking after common security? There's no chance whatever of all the countries in Europe agreeing on any particular foreign policy measure.
This is Larry Neild on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch. I'm talking to John Whittaker, an MEP in the European Parliament for UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party. Well, moving on, John, let me ask you this question. Excluding Gordon Brown, who's your favourite Prime Minister of all time?
I don't know. Can one have favourites on these? Certainly it wouldn't be Gordon Brown, but you didn't ask me that. I don't think one can have favourites on this. One can have differing degrees of respect for politicians, and obviously one would pay respect to Margaret Thatcher because she was a woman of conviction. That's what we lack these days. We lack politicians who we really believe are in there because they've got some ideal that they wish to put forward, and which is generally popular in the country. They're all spin doctors. They're all just out for solving today's problem, knee-jerk reactions all the time, like the problem with the recession in the coming up recession in the economy. What's Gordon Brown going to do about it? Oh, he's going to announce a package of new measures in the autumn, which will include, for instance, removal or reduction of stamp duty on house sales. Well, fine, Gordon. It's been pointed out by lots of people that if you want to do that, you don't tell people about it beforehand, and that's why there's been such a slump in house sales. Because they all think that stamp duty is going to be removed, so wait till October. It's all knee-jerk stuff. There is no vision, there is no forward thinking amongst the government, and I have to say also with the Conservatives. We have no vision from the Conservative Party, certainly not the Lib Dems. They're dancing from one place to the other, trying to get into the centre ground and never making it.
Why should we vote for UKIP at the next election? Because, in fact, there's our European elections take place next year, 2009.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's hard to read the tea leaves, but it's pretty unlikely that there's going to be a general election before June 2009, when the next Euro election comes up. And, of course, the Euro election is our natural territory because we're UKIP, and if anybody knows anything about UKIP, it's that we're the party that doesn't like the European Union, and most of Joe Public doesn't like the European Union either. And most of the public is thoroughly disillusioned with the Labour Party. They are not at all sure about where the Conservative Party is going. So I think, frankly, the external politics for UKIP is very, very strong for next June. I think we'll do terribly well.
Do you think people know enough about UKIP?
It's very hard to tell people about us. As I said, we've achieved the fact that most people have heard of us, and for a new political party, that's not bad going. People know that we exist, that most of them who know of us know that we also stand to pull Britain out of the European Union, and they agree with that. Beyond that point, it's very hard to keep people's interest long enough to tell them that we are the party of low taxation, we believe in selection in schools, we believe in solving the immigration problem, which will only be soluble once one is actually outside the European Union. When we get a few of those points across, people begin to understand and like us a lot.
Well, you mentioned immigration, because there have been allegations that UKIP has got a bit of a racist slant to it.
Well, that's a jolly easy way to try and put us down. We've got a lot of opponents out there, haven't we? The main parties don't like us at all because we take votes off them. And if you want to slander somebody else, the easiest thing to do is to call them racist. So I'm sorry, that thing washes off pretty much these days.
Well, you've got a PhD in nuclear physics, and as you said, you're a senior lecturer in economics at Lancaster University, but you've already decided to retire from your flirtation with politics.
As I said before, Larry, I never had any intention of being a politician. Retire? No, not at all. I'm always just as keen on the objectives of UKIP as I always was. There are some jolly good younger people coming up in the Northwest, and we are actually selecting candidates by voters, a ballot of members this week, and we shall know by the end of the week who is going to be top of the list for UKIP to stand in 2009. Let somebody else have a go. I don't relish going to Brussels and Strasbourg at all. In fact, I hate the travelling. And it's a waste of time, pretty much, as I say, when I get there.
But think of all those travelling expenses you could claim if you were commuting between Lancaster and Brussels.
Well, if I'm not going, I'm not claiming anywhere. That's true. And then I can't be accused of milking the system. And I think, frankly, this last year I've been to Brussels and Strasbourg the absolute minimum.
Don't you like going there? I mean...
No. It's nice to go once or twice, and Strasbourg's a lovely city, but when you go there, actually have hardly any opportunity to see the city at all. We're stuck in this revolting building, and which, by the way, did you know the roof's collapsed?
Really?
Yeah, the roof collapsed, and funnily enough, the bit of the roof that fell in was just where I sit.
Oh, wow. Conspiracy.
So, looks like a conspiracy, doesn't it? So, no, I don't like going there very much. I'm much happier in the north of England talking to real people.
Don't you need to go there to see what they're doing that you don't like so that you can come back and tell people?
Well, of course. That's what we try to do there. In fact, I quite enjoy insulting them when I get there. I have to say that's my sort of indulgence. I can stand up in front of all these other MEPs from all over Europe, and they're saying what a wonderful place this is, and always half the speeches are mutually congratulatory. Well done, my friend, for doing this wonderful report. What a great job you've done. And I can stand up and say, well, actually, no, I don't think it's such a great job. In fact, our view is that we should be out of this whole outfit. And it always goes down like a lead stone, but that's quite good fun. I don't mind doing that.
Well, I remember going to a press conference in Brussels, and you were there with the other MEPs, and they were giving out these messages about how wonderful it all is, and you kept butting in. I mean, they must hate you.
Yeah, they don't like us very much. But I do hope one thing, Larry, and that is that we have a measure of respect from them. Because I think we do have a principle that we all try to adhere to. And if we're just acting in accordance with those principles, they probably don't like us, but I think we probably find we earn a little respect.
Really?
Yeah.
So they will be praying that you'll do very badly next year, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And they will be saying all sorts of nasty things about us. Well, that's politics.
Well, I mean, I was reading that the Conservative leader, David Cameron, referred to UKIP members as fruitcakes, loonies and closet racist.
Well, so true, yes. In fact, we would rejoice...
Do you mean it's true that he said that?
It's true that he said that.
But it's not true what he said.
Frankly, we rather rejoice in the fruitcakes bit. There was a previous one by Howard, actually, when he called us cranks and gadflies. And on the basis of that, we formed the Gadfly Club. And over in Strasbourg, we got ties with cranks and gadflies on them.
Oh, really?
And that's what we use when we go out to dinner. The closet racist bit, obviously, that was a pretty slimy attack on us. And it was actually... Cameron was criticised by his own Conservative Party for making that remark about UK Independence Party, because a lot of them own up to the fact that in Euro elections they vote for us, and they didn't like that.
Well, it's one of those things, isn't it? Because I think people possibly find UKIP... a difficult entity, in as much as we know what Labour stands for or should stand for. Similarly with the Conservatives. UKIP comes along, you're quite new. I mean, you've got to earn your stripes maybe over many generations or decades.
Can I just question that statement you made?
Yeah,
there,
sure you
Larry.
Can.
You say we know what Labour stands for.
Oh, I think we know.
I don't think we do anymore, and I think that's one jolly good reason why people are turning away from Labour in droves. They used to know what Labour stood for. In the old days, when Labour was the Labour Party, which espoused socialism, you could actually pin a few principles to the Labour Party. I don't think that party's got a single principle to its name these days. It's clinging on by its fingernails with just day-to-day expediency and not having any forward-looking ideas at all. Now, Conservative Party, well, they've been out of power for 10 years now. They're quickly trying to find a place, but it's all going towards the centre ground again. And we're still pretty devoid of policies from the Conservative Party. They vaguely hint at lower taxation, for instance, and then turn round the following week and say, oh, well, the economy, the budget's in such a poor state that we can't do that after all. Sorry, chaps. Where's the principles in the Conservative Party?
Well, you might as well have a go at the Lib Dems as well while you're at it.
Well, it's always easy for the Lib Dems, isn't it? Because they can say exactly what they like, and by God, they've changed their minds often enough, because they know that they're not in power, and they're not going to get in power next time round, So it doesn't matter what they say. And so much of the vote for the Liberal Democrats has always been, well, we don't like the Tories, we don't like the Labour Party, then who are we going to vote for? The Lib Dem. I think the Lib Dems are the most ghastly lot. And when my son at university got his vote the first time, I said, hey, son, what are you going to vote? Who are you going to vote for? He said, well, I don't like Tories at Labour. I think I'll vote Lib Dem. I said, do you know what? If you vote Lib Dem, I'm going to excommunicate you and chuck you out of the house, because they are the least principled of the lot.
Oh, well, you better tell us now. What did he vote?
He didn't tell me in the end.
This is Larry Neild with the Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9. We're the voice of Liverpool. And my studio guest today is UKIP politician, or rather non-politician, John Whittaker, one of the 9 North West Euro MPs.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
You know, I love Buffet Star. Delicious, mouth-watering, scrumptious, piping hot, healthy Chinese and Thai food. Eat as much as you like for under 6 quid. And talking of squid, don't you just love it pan-fried with lashings of salt and chilli?
Mm-hmm. Buffet Star. 60 delicious Thai and Chinese dishes to choose from for less than 6 quid. Buffet Star. Hanover Street, Liverpool. Just round the corner from Central Station.
Is the Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. This is the Commons Touch with me, Larry Neild, on City Talk 105.9. I'm talking to John Whittaker, one of our 9 North West Euro MPs. John, of course, is from UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party. John, let me ask you this. UKIP had a spectacular fallout with your best-known member, Robert Kilroy Silk. He used to be an MP for Round Ayr Knowsley, in fact. Don't you need a big name like Kilroy Silk to front UKIP if you want to win over more of the public?
Well, yes, we'd like to have a big name, but not Kilroy Silk. He was a prima donna, he still is. He was good for us, I think, in gaining us a few extra votes in 2004. But as soon as the election was over, it became pretty obvious that he thought he was the leader of the party, almost by right, whereas we tend to do things democratically within the party, and the leader is elected by a ballot of all members. You don't just move into being leader of the UK Independence Party. You have to be voted in by members, and that means you have to gain the confidence of members and go around and meet a few. Well, the last thing that Kilroy ever wanted to do was actually to go and talk to ordinary people. That's just not his style. So pretty soon it became pretty obvious that he was no good, and that's when we fell out. But I suppose, on balance, he probably did us good in getting us more votes in 2004.
Couldn't you reconcile with him? Because, as I said, he was a pretty good frontman, wasn't he?
Yes, he got us a lot of airtime. Reconciliation, I tried. No, I don't believe it would have been possible. Can I just mention a point, though? You say we haven't got any front men, any high-profile figures. We've got Nigel. A lot of people know Nigel Farage, our leader. We also have, and you didn't mention this at the beginning, we've got 2 members of the House of Lords. Now, their names might not be dripping off everybody's lips, but certainly within the political scenery, these chaps are pretty well known. So we've got three people in Westminster now. That's 2 Lords and one MP. Obviously, we want more. But for a small party, I rate this as a pretty good achievement.
But the MP you've got in the Commons, he was elected as a Conservative.
Yes.
And he changed over to UKIP.
Yes, he did. And, of course, we will do our utmost the next time a general election comes up. When he will be standing for UKIP, we shall do our utmost to help him to be voted in as a UKIP person. And he's not done it without he's not changed over to UKIP without the blessing of his constituents. He's a very, very strong constituency MP in Castle Point near London there. And his constituency people, not the Conservative committee down there, but he tells me the people by and large very much support what he's done. So I'm hopeful we can get him back elected as a UKIP MP.
Because the thing is, John, that if we didn't have a system called proportional representation, you wouldn't even be a Euro MP, would you?
No, absolutely not.
Just let's explain, what is proportional representation?
Well, there's various forms of it, and it's a bit daft, in my opinion. It's given us the advantage of being able to get MEPs, but on the other hand, if you look at it, Here am I, I'm one of nine MEPs for the North West. North West stretches from Cumbria down to Carlisle in Cumbria down to Crewe. And there were something like 3 million voters and 5 million households. Of all those voters, I don't know very many of them very well. And the whole point about representation in a government or a parliament is that the representative should know and should be known by his electors. Well, how can that possibly be? You walk out into the streets of Liverpool, ask anybody, who are their MEPs, I'll bet you that they don't know one of us. It's a very poor system for representation.
Well, how it works briefly is, in the House of Commons, it's first past the post. If you get the most votes, you win.
Yes.
You could actually get, overall, quite a good margin of votes, but it doesn't count because you have to win. You have to be the winner.
Yes.
With proportional representation, everybody votes, and those votes are counted, and they're divvied up in a percentage basis, and you will get a number of seats depending on the percentage of votes that you get in the North West.
Yes, I should have explained that, you're quite right. You've explained it very well, Larry, but the effect of it is, as I say, that it divorces the representative, the MEP, from his constituents.
But the thing is that because of the way it works, because UKIP got quite a good slice of votes, that enabled you to wait. You got your seat in Brussels.
Yes.
What's the percentage? Is it? Do you know what it is?
In the Northwest, we got about 13% of the vote in 2004. Overall, round the country, I think we got 16% and actually beat the Liberal Democrats in 2004. We got more votes than them.
The thing is that if that happened in the Commons, the same system, proportional representation, you'd have quite a number of seats in the Commons as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, we should. We haven't had such great percentages in general elections, and that's what... It's very hard to break into a first-past-the-post election system, as you obviously realise from that description. So people don't see us, or have not in the past seen us, as gaining MPs. So the votes we've got in general elections, I mean, the highest percentage we got in, was it 2005, was one fellow got 10% of the vote. Well, that's not good enough to get somebody elected to Westminster. We've got to get past this point at which people believe that we're electable, and then we will be electable. It's a credibility gap.
But is there room in the British political makeup for a fourth, if you like, significant party?
I think you'll see significant changes in the British political makeup, if I can just use a crystal ball for a moment. People are getting totally fed up with voting for three parties, which are essentially all the same. And the result of that is the fall-off in turnout at all elections. There have been some council elections where only 10% of people have bothered
to
vote.
Liverpool.
Liverpool. Was it Liverpool? Yeah.
Yes, we've got that.
Yeah. There was the last Euro elections, about 40% voted. The previous one, there was only 25% voted. And the government and the Electoral Commission are looking at ways to try to make it easier to vote. Well, I can tell them how to get people to vote again, and that's to make votes mean something. But when you're voting for three political parties, essentially, who are not making the laws because the laws are being made in Brussels, and they know damn well it's going to make no difference which of those political parties comes into power, it's not surprising that people turn off in droves and don't bother to go to the polls. So we have these gimmicks like postal voting, electronic voting being talked about, and all of those, what all those things do is make it awful lot easier to fraud. And we've had... You know, we're the country that has led the way in democratic systems and systems of voting. Now we're leading the way in telling people how to run fraudulent elections.
Of course, I'm looking at one of your quotes, John. You've obviously confirmed this yourself today. None of us are politicians. We are ordinary people from a variety of backgrounds and experience who disagree with the EU running Britain's agriculture, fishing, defence, economic affairs, foreign policy and legal system. UKIP is the only party which believes that Britain would be better off out. And that's your vowed aim.
Well, yes, I stand very much by those words that you've kindly taken the trouble to find off our website.
I like the quote that you on your website again from the founder of the European Union. Europe's nations should be guided towards a super state without their people understanding what is happening. This can be accomplished by successive steps and disguised as having an economic purpose, but which will eventually and irreversibly lead to federation. That's a bit strong, isn't it?
It is a bit strong, but that's a direct quote, isn't it? Who was that from? I can't remember now.
Monet.
Oh, yeah, Jean Monnet. Jean Monnet, yes. One of the architects of European Union. And I think possibly that approach has been very well illustrated by the way that this latest treaty...
The Lisbon Treaty.
Lisbon Treaty. Call it treaty, call it constitution. They only changed the name, but it's basically the same thing. Where the European political elites and our own government have shown the deepest contempt for all the peoples of Europe, all the voters, and by refusing to give them referendums, and where you have one in Ireland, because the Irish constitution said they had to have a vote on this, and if they voted against the European Union, and yet within 2 or 3 weeks you've got Mr. Sarkozy going over there and telling them, oh, you've got to vote again, you got it wrong. Now tell an Irishman he got it wrong, and I think if you had another vote in the Irish Republic, you'll find that it's an even stronger no than it was last time. But what will they do? They'll just ride roughshod over it. In fact, half the things that the Lisbon Treaty was going to permit to be put into place, they're being put in place already, like the Foreign Diplomatic Service from the European Union, interference in our court systems, common immigration policy. Mr. Sarkozy's promising that that will be all a part of the French presidency between now and December. And yet these things are really only given permission to continue by the treaty which hasn't yet been ratified.
I was reading just a week or so ago after the Olympics that somebody was saying, I can't remember who it was now, that Europe should enter a team in the Olympic Games. So rather than have Team GB and Team France and whatever, we should have Team EU. What do you think of that idea?
Well, they'd love it, wouldn't they? Of course, that's the way they're trying to do. They're trying to have everything European. At the moment, for instance, your listeners might have read something about the World Trade Organization. Well, that's where we all negotiate to try to get tariffs cut between various countries, and it's broken down, as you probably know. On the other hand, we are not represented as Britain. We are represented as the European Union. And what our government and what this country thinks and feels, we have to pass to Peter Mandelson, who's the Trade Commissioner, to argue on our behalf. But he's got to argue on behalf of all the 27 European countries. And I have to say that the country that seems to have the greatest influence at the moment is France, with its protectionism, with its looking after its own farmers to the detriment of our farmers. And they're the ones that have the ear of Peter Mandelson, who is negotiating for all of us at the World Trade Organization. That's what the European Union wants. It wants everything to be European. It doesn't want individual nations in anything.
This is Larry Neils on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch. And I'm talking to John Whittaker, one of the 9 Northwest Euro MPs. And John is from UKIP. John, moving on, I thought one point that illustrated your cynical view about Europe is the fact that Blackpool Lights could be threatened by one European legislation.
Yes, I did have a press release about that. It was published in Blackpool. This is this
idea. The light bulb. Yeah. The light bulbs. The light bulbs.
That's the light bulb. It's the European Union move.
Got to go to low energy bulbs.
We've got to go to low energy bulbs. We've got to rule out incandescent bulbs.
Incandescent bulbs are the ones like the 100 watt or the 60 watt that we know and love.
Yeah, the ones we've been using a long time. With a filament in it, and it, everybody's familiar with the ordinary old bulb. Now what they want to do is these nasty sort of incandescent things, which are supposedly much less, they consume much less power. And when I spoke to the guy who was running the Blackpool lights on the tower, he told me that they've got thousands and thousands of the old-fashioned incandescent type of light bulbs, and if this directive comes into force, he would be expected to replace all these with the incandescent ones. And they're all low wattage, these, so you actually can't get incandescent ones that would fit the bill. So what would happen, we don't know. But there are hundreds of silly cases like this where unintended consequences of EU legislation have actually come to pass. We might find this one never does. In fact, I think probably it won't in this case, but there are plenty of examples where EU legislation has been put in and caused the most ridiculous results.
Because I thought that we were already starting to phase out the traditional light bulbs. I started stocking them in the loft, you know, to last me the rest of my life, because, you know, these low-energy ones, they remind me of gas mantles.
Yes, they do.
They're miserable, aren't they?
And they don't go on properly when you turn them on. You have to wait. I've got one in the cellar, and I turned it on. I fell down the steps the other day because the light didn't go on quick enough. So no. I put an incandescent one back again.
But they are miserable, aren't they, these low-energy bulbs? If you're feeling depressed, I think if you're sat reading under one of those lights, you should probably kill yourself.
There's another problem which has been pointed out. They've actually got mercury in them, you know.
Really?
Oh, yes. And another piece of the EU has decided that mercury is a jolly bad idea, as you know, and you can't dispose of anything these days with mercury in it. They've even banned the manufacture of mercury barometers now and put a whole lot of small businesses out of business as a result. So mercury is a real no-no, and yet these bulbs have got mercury in them. And if you read the instruction, if you break one of these bulbs, you know, you're supposed to open your windows for half an hour and go outside and then let the local environmental agency know, and they'll come and tell you when you can go back inside.
These are these little funny-shaped things that we get from the supermarket.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Well, that's what they're talking about.
What about, if they don't like mercury, what about dental mercury, amalgams?
Oh, that's another one, yes. There's an... You're reminding me of lots of lovely stories here. You know what? When they're putting a lot of small crematoria out of business these days because they can't... it's obviously, when you cremate a body which has got mercury in its teeth, then the mercury is going to go up the chimney, and that's mercury pollution. So now the idea is to get all crematoria have to have mercury scrubbing apparatus in the crematorium, and that's going to put small ones out of business.
Why can't they just use dental students to whip the teeth out before they burn them?
I think that will be viewed with some distaste, I'm afraid.
I would imagine you're right, yes. Yeah. I'm being a bit cynical there. But yes, and Europe has got this reputation for coming up with the most balmy rules, and I think they give themselves a bad press.
Yes.
And the other thing, I guess, about Europe, and you touched on this before, I get the impression that we are the only country in Europe that play by the rules, and everybody else, nobody else does. You mentioned France.
Yes, well, that's absolutely right, Larry. If you go, for instance, to Spain or Portugal in particular, you go out to the open market, for instance, and are they obeying the hygiene rules? Are they held? And you find there's their products displayed in the open, in the heat, with flies on them. They get shut down in no time by our health and safety, obeying all the EU rules here. Go over there, they don't mind. They don't take any notice of them. When the French have trouble with the fishing, for instance, when they're told that they're not supposed to fish over quota, then the French just sort of turn a blind eye when we busily prosecute our fishermen. Our British fishing industry is a third of the size that it originally was because we obey the rules. The Spanish and French have bigger quotas than ourselves, and not even those quotas are properly enforced by themselves.
Well, John, in your Britain, we come out of the EU. Could we survive? And how can we survive?
I think the better question to ask, if I may, is how will we survive if we stay in? Because with the amount of legislation that's coming our way, it's detrimental to business, and we're in the Northwest here, we're rather good at running businesses. But time after time, I'll talk to small business people, and they say they are suffering. How can we survive without the European
Union? Let me just ask, how much do we pay to the EU every year as a country?
The gross contribution is about £15 billion a year.
£15 billion?
That's about, what, £30 million a day.
£30 million a day?
Yes.
To be in that club?
That's what we pay, yes.
But do they give us £40 million back?
No, they give us, out of that £15 billion, we get perhaps £9 billion back as agricultural grants, and then these structural funds, some of which, of course, has been used for regenerating Liverpool city centre here.
So we've got a lot to thank them for then here, haven't we?
Well, thank you for giving us a bit of our money back with strings attached after you've taken half of it and kept it in your pocket. Is that what we should be thanking them for?
Maybe not. So we could survive. We could, you know, we could be, Britain could be great again without being in the EU.
Not just survive, we would be better, because we would be able, for instance, to reopen our trade relationships with the former Commonwealth, which is now a very important part of the trading world. I'm talking about countries like Australia and New Zealand, who we sorely snubbed when we joined the EU and said, all right, we've got to put tariffs on imports from you guys. We've got India, which is coming up very fast, part of the Commonwealth, and UKIP's trade policy is, in fact, to form a Commonwealth trade area, which would be, as far as possible, a tariff-free area with the Commonwealth. We'd do wonderfully well. And all these stories about not being able to trade with the EU is nonsense. They still want to sell us our cars. The French still want to sell us their wines. And they always sell us more than we sell to them, so it's in their interest to continue.
Because the Commonwealth, of course, is bigger than the EU, isn't it?
Oh, very much so, yes. India alone is bigger than the EU.
Well, give me a prediction. Will we ever come out? If we had a referendum tomorrow in Britain, should we stay or should we leave? What do you think the result would be?
That's a hard one. If we had a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, I'm very sure that it would be no, and a very, very solid no. If we had a referendum on whether we should stay in or out, it so much depends upon what the question is. People still are afraid of what the future will bring when we come out. And, of course, the main parties will try to sell the referendum question by phrasing it in such a way as to strike fear into people that if they vote, yes, we'd like to come out, oh, you're moving into some empty vacuum where you don't know where you're going. There's a big problem there to get the actual fact across, and I'm not in the business of trying to educate people. We are just trying to connect with people's well-understood misgivings about the European Union. I can predict solidly that we will be out at some point. As an economist, I sort of look at things like the euro, and my strong prediction is that the euro, the currency, which 15 European nations now use, that's not going to last over about 2 or 3 years because of the very severe strains between Spain and France and Portugal on the one hand, and Italy and Germany on the other. They need different interest rates and they can't have them.
So they go back to the old money. We'll get the French francs back and the Spanish pesetas.
Yep, that's the way things are going to go. And there'll be the most awful financial turmoil, the most awful legal arguments about debts when they're redenominated into old currencies, because there's no provision made for this. But the strains are very, very severe.
Well, John Whittaker, you've given us a very enlightening view of Europe, and it's been fascinating. And it's about, well, you know, obviously I've read up about UKIP, so it's what I'd expect you to say, and it's good to get the other side of the coin, as it were, the other side of the euro in this case. This is Larry Neild on the Commons Touch, City Talk 105.9. And my studio guest has been John Whittaker, one of the 9 Northwest Euro MPs. John, of course, is from UKIP. And I'll be back with more after this. But, John, thanks for coming in.
A pleasure. Thank you, Nate.
City Talk 105.9. Listen again now at citytalk.fm.
This is The Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back to me, Larry Neild, on the Commons Touch here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. I'm now joined by Mike Leyland, who's a researcher with the Aerial Trust here in Liverpool. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon, Larry.
Mike, what's the Aerial Trust? Do you put things on roofs and things?
Aerial Trust, yeah, basically work with young people and get them experiencing radio.
Oh, really?
Essentially.
I thought you put aerials on roofs, no.
Well, that's what some people think. We've had a few different...
Or make washing powder.
Yeah, we do check how white our whites are.
So you help young people working in the media?
Yeah, particularly try and improve their confidence generally and give them some sort of transferable skills, particularly working with unemployed youngsters.
You were involved recently in the European Youth Parliament coming here to Liverpool. And I remember we did a bit on that here on City Talk, and it was really successful. The guy I interviewed today, John Whittaker, he's from UKIP. The number one mission in life, I think their only mission in life, is to drag us out of Europe.
Right, yeah.
What would you say to him?
That's an interesting point of view.
Really? Yeah.
It's not what I share. It's what I'd quite vehemently against that. I think... it's surprising that in this day and age that people have still got that sort of opinion, that black and white view. I think in reality we have to look at the European Union as somewhere in between. I think it's useful having opinions like that, I suppose. But I think you've got to look at the European Union. You've got, have to look around the city, Larry. You know, look at what is being built, the regeneration that goes on in this city.
This could have happened anyway, though, couldn't it?
I don't think that's true. I think Objective One funding started this ball rolling in Liverpool. If you look at all the building, the Capital Culture Initiative really has regenerated this region.
So if we were still in the Commonwealth, you don't see Australia and New Zealand shovelling their money at us to improve Liverpool?
Well, no, I don't see, to be honest. I think the days gone by, you know, we might have had trade links. The history of this city, you know, look, talk about the slave trade and the sort of history we built there. And we've got to move on from that. We've now got them in museums, and that, I think, speaks volumes for sort of what John Whittaker's talking about.
Well, John thinks, and his opinion is shared by many, that we could succeed as a nation, as Great Britain, by, you know, rekindling our trading arrangements with the Commonwealth.
I mean,
and the Commonwealth is bigger than the EU.
The Commonwealth is bigger than the EU, but then if you look at the sort of nations involved, that's no disrespect to the likes of Swaziland, you know, Jamaica, the Seychelles. I think you'll find we haven't got a great deal in common with their economies, and we haven't got a great deal in common with, if you're talking about Commonwealth, what have we got in common with them anymore?
But what have we got in common with Europe?
Well, if you talk about...
Apart from being the next door neighbour.
Well, I think... In reality, that is one of the key things, and that does make trade a lot easier. If you live next door to someone, it's a lot easier to trade whatever you're trading with your next door neighbour. But I think if you look at our key partners, trade partners, still at the top. I mean, obviously you've got America, but Germany, France, Italy, all the key players in Europe are still our major trade partners, imports and exports.
The thing is that because of your age, you were born into the European Union.
Yeah.
You know, you've been a European all your life.
Yeah.
Because we joined in 73, was it 73?
That's right.
So people of your generation have never known anything apart from being a member of the European Union. I mean, some of us around were born in the days of the British Empire, which is long gone. And
you weren't around then, Larry, surely?
I'm not going to talk about that. I remember Queen Victoria very well. Anyway.
Well, Henry VIII.
No, not that far back. No. Let's be sensible. Yes. But you've only ever known life in Britain as part of the EU.
True.
So you've grown up with it.
True.
So you probably can't remember how good it used to be.
Well, I resent that view straight away, how good it used to be, that sort of rose-tinted spectacles of back in the day, it was all perfect and everything worked nicely. You know, it's just not true. And I think by John Whittaker and his party saying things like this, it moves them further away from the young people. It really does alienate them because young people can't relate to those sort of opinions.
One of the things about Europe, of course, is that it's got this huge collection of languages, and that doesn't make life easy, does it?
It doesn't, but you have to be careful what you say here, but I think English is, you know, has been for some time, although the French might not like to admit it has been the working language of the EU, although there's two dual languages, obviously, and it continues to grow as a world language and across the EU, and it makes things a lot easier. You know, the European Youth Parliament event is all done in English and French. 98% of it is done in English.
One of the heartening things I read a day or so ago is that in a few years' time, England, Great Britain, will be the biggest country in the EU. Will overtake France and Germany. At the moment, France is going to have 72 million, Germany 71. We're going to go up. Well, actually, I want to say soon. It's actually 2060.
I was going to say, we've got 60 million now. We've got a way to go.
We're going to be 77 million is the estimated population of United Kingdom in 2060. And that's a rise of 25%. We're going to put all these people.
That's a good question.
Us Brits would, we'll have to go. We'll have to move to Europe to make way for all these people coming in.
Yeah, but I think that is increasing already with the European Union. Some of the initiatives they do at university. There's a lot more people, a lot more young people travelling, going abroad, and moving away. And, you know, I've considered myself, and a lot of people I know have considered looking abroad if they've not found a job initially here.
This is Larry Neal on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch, and I'm talking to Mike Leyland from the Aerial Trust, and we're talking about the EU. Well, sticking with the EU, Mike, if you go on holiday, say you go a long way away, away from Europe, and somebody says, where are you from, what do you say? I bet you don't say, I'm from Europe.
Well, I actually had this discussion 2 weeks ago when I was away in Croatia, and I actually ended up saying, from Liverpool.
Really?
Because you got the best response if you said you're from Liverpool, which made me quite proud.
Really?
We have this question of, do you say you're from Europe, from Great Britain, I think, or from the UK? People shy away from saying that. They'd rather say, in fact, even England, people would rather say from north of England than England.
Really? I'm trying to think, what do I say? I would say I'm from England.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd say I'm from Great Britain, because it's too long.
Yeah. No, and I think I do tend to say England. I think it's devolution.
I mean, Americans always ask you, are you from London, England?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I say Liverpool now, because it kind of solves that, it beats that question out of the way.
Yes, it does.
And people generally, most people will know Liverpool if they don't know where it is.
Well, there's about seven Liverpools in the world, though, isn't there? How do they know you're from this one?
Well, there's only one real Liverpool.
One. I wonder whether we're with the original or whether we nicked it from somewhere else.
We probably did.
No, well, no. Okay, no.
So let's not use those jokes.
No, indeed, no. One of the issues I have about the EU, of course, is that it's it doesn't have the level of accountability that I think it should have. In fact, in 73, I voted against staying in.
Yeah.
Not because I'm anti-European. In fact, probably now I'd still vote to stay in.
Yeah.
Or rather, I would vote to stay in. But I felt that the accountability, the way the whole machine works, is anti-democratic.
No, I agree in a way with that. I'm not totally staunch pro-Europe. I think there are problems the way the European Union, the European Parliament, and the Commission and all the other institutions work. I think one of the things that they're trying to do, they tried it with the Constitution. The Lisbon Treaty now is trying to improve that accountability and the effectiveness of it. Unfortunately, what happens to that, Larry, is it gets caught up in this sort of far-right politics and in the far-right media, and they spin that nicely so that it just looks like, we're going to lose all our sovereignty. Which is just not true.
Well, you mentioned the Lisbon Treaty, and the Irish Europe Minister, Dick Roche, is saying that he thinks that they'll have to go back to the people for what seems like a second referendum. And he said, I know what's going to happen. The Irish are going to be told to vote until they say yes. They'll just be pestered.
Mm.
And they might as well just throw their hands up and say, look, we're going to have to say yes one day. Why don't we just say yes and get it over with?
Yeah. I'm not sure what I think about the Irish situation. I've got to be honest. I don't agree with what happened, first of all. You know, the fact that they had, the puppet, whoever's the Eurovision entrant from Ireland, they had adverts up with him saying, oh, this is what we'll end up like if we go with Europe, the puppet. You know, that the whole campaign there, speaking to some of my Irish friends, was just ridiculous. But at the same time, I don't think we should go the other way and push people into supporting the EU. I don't think that's fair either. I think there's got to be an open debate, which hasn't happened this time. I doubt it'll happen the next time.
Well, I went into a Morrison supermarket yesterday, and I saw the Irish Times.
Yeah.
So I thought, because they had a feature on the Lisbon Treaty,
yeah,
and I thought I'd buy it because I'll read up on it, see what they're saying in Ireland. In fact, it's quite interesting because the woman was trying to charge me £1.80 for the paper. I said, that's euros. It's not £1.80. This is another thing.
Yeah.
I said, that's in euros. No, it says £1. No, it's €1.80. So we settled on a pound.
But negotiating.
But the thing is that this feature was saying that half the people who voted no in the referendum in Ireland voted no because they didn't have a clue what it was about. So they just voted no. And I think that in a way, is one of the complications of a long-winded treaty. I mean, if you look at... Okay, let's look at the America. They have the rules there. They're one-liners.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Americans, they invented the sound bites with, the Declaration of Independence and all those are one bite. Article 1, Article 2. They're just one-liners. So why can't they do a Lisbon Treaty that's like that so that everyone can understand it?
Yeah, I think the problem is we can't even agree constitution in this country. You know, Gordon Brown's put that on the table. So how are we going to agree constitution with, 28 other countries? I don't know if we'll ever get that far.
Well, this is the problem. And in fact, we had this. Have you been reading about this row over the sugar cube?
I've seen a little bit about it. Yeah.
Well, the Czech Republic, is it a republic?
The Czech
Republic is going to take over the presidency of the EU. Right. It goes around, doesn't it, at the moment?
Yeah,
so they get 6 months. So it's going to move over to Prague.
Yeah.
For 6 months. So they had this wonderful PR campaign to celebrate the fact that they're going to be running the big European show for 6 months.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this, but apparently the Czechs invented the sugar cube.
That's right. Yeah.
So they're using as a logo the sugar cube with a one-liner. And when they translated it, it meant, "We'll make things sweeter for Europe." Which sounds kind of cool, doesn't it? They're coming from the... But then the other linguists from other countries said, actually, as well as saying that, you could also translate that logo as saying, "We'll give Europe a taste of its own medicine."
Both of, equally well effective, depending on political party, you believe.
But that is the complete reverse of what the Czechs were trying to make the point. And that's the point I was making before about the language difficulties.